Okay, thank you very much. First of all, I'd like to thank the organizers, Mark, Kurt, and Paul Atzberger, for inviting me to give this presentation. So what I'd like to tell you is some of the efforts we have been doing to use particles, not only for doing atomistic and mesoscopic simulations, or perhaps particles are well known for, but also how to use them to do continuum simulations. And this gives us kind of a unifying framework, if you like, to describe phenomena from the atomistic all the way to the continuum scale. And hopefully it gives us the opportunity to facilitate the interfacing of these different scales. Before I describe the particles, I'd like to say a few things about multiscaling. And I guess multiscaling means a lot of things to a lot of different people. There is one approach that I found very interesting. So in the next movie that you will see, try not to think that these are people, but try to think that these are molecules to facilitate the concept of multiscale that I'd like to talk about. So here is the movie that we have. So you have to consider now that these are molecules exerting forces on each other. And then there is a certain energy landscape that you see here that the different kinds of molecules are traversing. So this, this approach to multiscaling as causality, actually this idea of using war to describe multiscale modeling, I learned it from reading some beautiful work by Robert Ulanovich. And the idea there is that usually when we look at a battle, or when we look at a war or an instant of the war, we usually have this approach of having the material and the mechanical. The material is the spears, and the mechanical is the people who are actually using the spears to exert forces on each other. And this gives us this classical Newtonian view of the world, where we have forces and potentials. So this material and mechanical is, if you like, the world according to Newton. Now, when you have war, there's more things that are going on. Besides yourself, there's also whole armies. And also, more interesting, there is also boundaries, and there is different landscapes that you have to negotiate. And there is other events and other parts of the battle that are affecting what's going to happen to you. And finally, this is the formal part, if you like, of actions that are being taken. And then finally, there is the final part, where the outcome of the battle will determine perhaps what happens to a nation or other things. So this idea of causality and looking multiscaling as causality and the material, mechanical, formal, and final aspects of the world are attributed to Aristotle. And if you like, they're a complement to the Newtonian view of the world. So the idea is that you have individuals fighting, and you have also boundaries that you have to respect. So the talk today is to tell you a few things. The first idea is to convince you that particles are a superset of grid-based methods. So in fact, this is a heretic view. In fact, what I'd like to show you, that if you do particle methods, you are also doing finite difference methods. Also, you can do finite elements, etc. So it's enough if you do particles. The next thing I want to show you is how you can have particles that they have different resolutions. And then I'll talk about something called particle wavelets. And then I'll tell you a few things about boundaries and interfaces. How do we impose boundary conditions in macro scale? And how do we bridge atomistic and continuum? And perhaps an idea of how perhaps one can bridge between flux and domain decomposition algorithms for interfacing continuum and atomistic simulations. So what are particles? Particles are entities that are moving. So one equation that we have to follow is the equation of motion of the particles. And now the particles in the continuum world, they can carry properties such as velocity, vorticity, or density. And what you see up here is Newton's equation, if you like, in the continuum world. And then particle methods in the continuum world, this is two vortex tubes. And what you see with the dots, these are the computational elements that are Lagrangian and are following basically the vorticity field. But what we are solving is this pair of equations there. Now there is other particles, again Newton's equation, except on the right hand side you don't have the divergence of a stress tensor, you have a force field that comes out as a gradient of the potential. And then here, we can include techniques like molecular dynamics, dissipative particle dynamics, and all this beautiful coarse-graining work that you do. Now, what's the difference between the two? The difference between the two is quite important. What you do on the particles up there is you use particles as quadrature points to approximate the partial differential equation. So there, what you usually do actually is you take the partial differential equation and you replace it with integral operators, and then the particles are quadrature points that can move around. In this case, the particles are models of a physical system. So there is an important distinction between approximation and modeling, which we have to respect, but then all the machinery, all the computational tools, etc., that are behind to move particles, track them, and evolve them are quite the same. And actually, just to give you an idea of how you can put the two together, so here are some old simulations where we take this experiment of Tintenpilze. There was music to that, but you will not see it, you will not hear it. The idea here is that you use particles to represent a drop of milk, and then you give them certain properties of how they interact, and then you use other particles to solve the flow equations. So what you will see in a second is solid particles, which are the yellow, and then vorticity isosurfaces that are coming down. There is a two-way coupling between the particles and the fluid. The particles are imposing vorticity on the fluid, and vice versa, the vorticity induces a velocity field on the particles that you see. So here we actually have a simulation with two kinds of particles. One kind of particle approximates the blue stuff, which is vorticity, which is a continuum field. And the other set of particles, the other set of particles, if you like, is modeling the solid. So we can actually just quickly show you that you can do other things. Again, here is the white ones are models, and the red field is represented also by particles. So particle methods are unique. So as far as I understand, there is no other numerical method, finite differences, finite elements, spectral methods, who can do all these different things that particle descriptions can do. So here are some examples from work in our lab. We have been using particles as in molecular dynamics to study water and carbon nanotubes. We have been using particles to study cell organelles. This is frap or diffusion on the surface of an endoplasmic reticulum. We have been using particle models inspired by molecular dynamics to model cells. So here are some ideas of how you can study cell proliferation. We have been using them to do angiogenesis, and I have another talk in the Cancer Symposium on Friday on that. And also in more classical fluid mechanics things, we have been using them to do fish hydrodynamics, and we have been using them to study vortex rings. And I think that's the power of particle methods, but I put multiscale up there in gray because these simulations are not multiscale. There are simulations at different scales, and in fact, to be able to do multiscale, what I need to do is I need to close these gaps that I have in between, and perhaps these are some of the ideas that I'll tell you as during this talk. So, just to understand why particles are a superset of grid-based methods. Let's start by telling you how particles approximate a function. So you take a function, you write it as a convolution with delta functions, and then you take these delta functions and you smooth them with smoother functions, and then you do quadratures. These are point particles, these are smooth particles. So I want you to pay attention that when you have particles in continuum simulations, you have two length scales. The first length scale has to do with the modification that you have introduced here for the delta function. The second length scale has to do with the distance between particles. So there is a big hoopla and a lot of hype about particle methods in the continuum world, people who do SPHs, etc., that particles are mesh-free, and I'd like to challenge that precisely because of these two length scales that you see here. So let's see what you can do with particles. So you can do perhaps surfaces. So here is a surface, and I represent it as level sets. this gives me the possibility of a singular function to represent it as a continuum function by upping by one dimension the description. This is the function, and then what I need to evolve, usually you do that in material processing, is you need a velocity field that usually depends on the geometry to evolve that. I was actually very surprised that nobody had ever done this with particles, because very simply what you do is you take the level set, approximate it with particles, and all you have to do is move the particles. And here is a complex geometry, actually, you can represent with particles. You put any kind of surface you want down. You put down a cube of particles. This is the grid, if you like, and now we have to solve partial differential equations on this. But I'd like to show you that this is quite easily possible. Now, when you advect and you use this Lagrangian description, if you have solid body rotations, particle level sets are exact. Because this is, you're basically solving exactly the convection equation. So this is a test that people do in level sets. They have a disk and then it has some gradients here. And when you use a grid-based method like this one, this gap here may disappear. When you do it with Lagrangian particle level sets, you get it to stay exact. Now, life is not always easy, and here's another exact solution. This is an exact solution of the Euler equations, and now you take a circular vorticity, and you can take your favorite particle code, vortex code, SPH, etc., and if you just plainly use it, you're going to get garbage. Actually, you don't get really garbage. You get something like that, and that's why people who do SPH like galaxies, and they do galaxy formation, but this is wrong. Okay, and this is a simple test that SPH people should do. Now, how do you fix that, and why do you have that? You have that because your particles go apart because of the strain field of the domain. And if you go and you respect what some very nice mathematicians have done, they tell you that particle methods have two errors that depend on the two length scales. The first error comes because you take this delta and you modify it, and you have an error term that goes like that, and that depends on the moments of this particular modification. And the second error has to do with the quadrature of this field, and if h over epsilon is larger than 1, the method does not converge. And what you just saw before is just a simple presentation that the method does not converge if h becomes larger than epsilon. So when particles go apart, they stop to be exact, so there is no such thing as a grid-free particle method, in my opinion. Now, how to fix it? People who do solid mechanics, they have been actually active in trying to fix that. Basically, we try to restore partition of unity. I'd like to show you a simple way of how we go about it and why does it help us. So what you do is you reproject particles on a mesh. And it's actually a very simple reprojection because the mesh is very simple. So there's no mesh free, but then all the tricks that people do with mesh-based methods we can do, plus we can do high CFL, plus we can do multi-resolution and multi-scaling. How does it work? You take the particles, you don't like them anymore because they've gone apart. You put down a mesh, a regular mesh, I insist on that. You interpolate between mesh and particles. You use a moment-conserving interpolation, and these are moments between the field before and after. And then you get rid of the grid, if you like. You get also rid of the old particles. What you have done is taken the orange and made translated them into blue, and these are my new particles. So very simple technique. And in fact, what you see up there has been done with this method, and we do get the exact solution, which is boring, but nevertheless it's exact. So this is how it works. You do advect always on particles. You remesh, you solve derivatives, etc., on the mesh, and you resample. This is, in fact, what makes this method different from the classical particle itself, just this line. Now, I know that one question that everybody says is this remeshing that you do is dissipative, and it's not. And I'll show you why it's not, and I'll show you now why particle methods are a superset of grid-based methods. So now, if I want to conserve moments, the number of moments I conserve depends on the size of my remeshing stencil. And it's actually a simple linear system of equations that you solve, that you try to conserve as many moments as you want by using as many grid points as you want. So if I have a particle here, And if I use 3 points, I can conserve 0, 1, and 2 moments. So I can conserve 3 moments. And actually, what is interesting that I will not talk about is that you can have actually different types of remeshing of where you do that. But let's look at this one. Now, if you do look at this one, this is the distance of the particle from the grid point. You can recover in order to conserve the moments or the 3 moments of this particle. You have to give that much to this particle, to this grid point, that much to this grid point, that much to this grid point. Now, of course, we have more than one particle, but then let's keep these coefficients here in mind. Now, let's look at this simple equation where all the finite difference schemes are usually being built upon. This is a simple advection equation. In principle, you can solve it like that, but now we don't solve it like that, we remesh. And now, how bad is that? How bad is that? Is let's put down a grid, and then that's the initial location of our particles. I advect them with Euler, and then they arrive over there. And then this is again where I'm going to do my remeshing. When I do my remeshing, let's look at this grid point, because this grid point now it's going to receive strength from 3 particles. So it's going to receive a strength from this particle. And how much is that? It's based on the previous formula. It's given from here. And I remind you that the strength of this particle is the same as it was here. That's why you have this formula. The same thing can be done for the second particle, and the other thing can be done for the third particle. And we have a nice formula up there that now if you forget the word particles and you look at it, this is a finite difference scheme. So for $50, who knows what a scheme is this? I always win this bet. It's a pity, actually. But how about now for $20 in this form? Okay, so this is the beam-warming finite difference scheme. And I can actually convince you that any finite difference scheme that there is, I can derive it by choosing different types of remeshing. So if instead of doing this one-sided remeshing, I have done central remeshing, I can recover Lax-Ventrov, etc., etc., etc. So in a sense, when you do particles plus remeshing, you recover all the finite difference schemes. So now what we can do with that is we can do lots of simulations. So here is one simulation where we're using 10 billion particles. Today we can do on 40,000 processors 300 billion particles. And the nice thing about that is because we use grids, and then we can do nice FFTs, etc. So we can have all these fancy structures of a vortex wake, and we can admire that. But then there is a problem. Now, the particles are adaptive, but they're not very good. And they're not very good because they're all the same size. So we have to do something about that. And people who do grid-based methods, they have been doing something about that. They have been introducing adaptive mesh refinement. Adaptive mesh refinement has usually low compression rate, gradient, and curvature, and there is no explicit control of the compression error. So here is an idea of how we can improve. We can do wavelet compression, and this is, I guess, the idea of wavelet compression. Depending on how many coefficients you keep, that's the picture that you get. And what we do basically is after we do remeshing, we're going to do a wavelet analysis of the field, and then the particles that they will have, or the grid nodes that they will have a low value, we're basically going to discard them. So this is what's going to look like about my particles or my grid nodes, if you like, during the wavelet analysis. And when I discard them, this is how I'm going to have a multi-resolution analysis of my field. And now what I do is I advect all the particles on the different levels. And here is an example of a level set formulation. You compute the error of how this thing begin a circle should go back to be a circle. This is some of the best results by Enright and Fedkio. And this is the convergence that we get. And we can have also a very high CFL. The classical CFL should be less than 1, does not apply to Lagrangian methods. And here's another example of shock bubble interaction where you can see the adaptivity of the grid as we are tracking the density interfaces. Now, boundaries to this. And what we like to do here is something that engineers do when they go and refine around complex structures. So when we want to couple from the atomistic and the continuum, we want them to exchange forces. Now, what are these forces? How do we get these forces? That's the next thing that I want to say about. So first of all, what I'd like to do is I'd like to solve for the continuum in a simple grid. And a simple grid, it doesn't get as simpler than that. And why do I want to do that? I want to do that because I can do things fast on this grid, and that's on this grid I can do 300 billion particles. If you complicate the grid or mesh nodes, whatever you like, I cannot do it. And then what I do is I add a force there, and now of course there is an incompatibility, but there's different solutions to that. One solution is that you, let's say you want to enforce the no-slip boundary condition, well, you use the penalization method, which is you use something like an error function that goes zero outside, and then it's one inside the domain, and that's this chi of s, and that's the penalization technique. Or you can do a delta function approximation of the boundary, and this is the famous immersed boundary method due to Charles Peskin and several people who worked on this after that. So the story is that we use regular grids, and then we embed in there a force field to satisfy the boundary conditions. We can do complicated things like this because you cannot do this with other grids, if you like. And now, of course, since we can do multi-resolution, since these surfaces can be represented implicitly by level sets, I can do multi-resolution and refine to increase my accuracy in this domain. And therefore, I can do things like these cylinders that I saw you here. Now, this is a nasty problem, and this is a nasty problem because it has an analytical solution. So you can check your codes when you do the different grid particle codes, etc., whether you get the analytical solution. And lots of different grid-based codes don't get it. There is also something very interesting here, that the flow is very forgiving. So these are another formulation that another colleague has done with finite differences. Hans Johnston, I think, is in Boston. And what you see is this is the drag coefficient. And what you see is that no matter how bad you are initially, you recover. And that actually can be a very misleading thing when you test numerical methods. So enter the famous lattice-Boltzmann method and coupling with immersed boundaries, where people use it a lot to do soft matter and other things. And what you can see from here, that this method is actually not so accurate. And depending on the kind of forcing that you do, you can be second or one and a half order accurate. And if you push the Reynolds number, you get actually a lot worse results than what you see here. So I suggest this as a benchmark problem when you do these couplings. Now, we have here so far been knowing what is the boundary condition, and we have been using this penalization and immersed boundary techniques to enforce this particular boundary condition. Now, obviously, what can happen is that the boundary condition that we want to enforce, we actually can get it out of an MD simulation. So this F, if you like, comes out of an atomistic simulation. Now, we have been looking into different ways to do that. We have been looking into the classical Schwarz domain decomposition technique, where there is an overlap between the atomistic and the continuum. The continuum evolves, and then what you have to do is you evolve on the grid, as I saw here, and then you have to find out what happens in the continuum, and you pass boundary conditions to the atomistic. The atomistic evolves, you pass conditions back. Schwarz domain decomposition has problems in the sense that you are not conservative in terms of your fluxes, etc. And what we have done, actually, almost by mistake, we actually found a way to actually bridge domain decomposition and flux algorithms. And the way we do that is we don't map between the atomistic and the continuum in only one cell, but we are actually using two contiguous cells to map between the atomistic and the continuum. So in a sense, this is a poor man's approximation of a gradient of the velocity field. So we have been looking into this, and I'll show you a comparison of how this fares compares to the velocity-only approximation. So I'll show you first for a simple case. Well, actually, this is I want to say a few things about one more thing that is important, and that has to do that also when you do multiscaling, you forget that when you do molecular dynamics, you usually have periodic domains. Here, you don't have any more periodicity. So all these molecules that you forget induce problems to you, and usually these problems, you see them as density fluctuations. One way to fix that is by computing the pair using the pair correlation function of the liquid in consideration and computing what is the potential of mean force. And then this is a subject that has been over some debate. Different people have used different things. And I think this pair correlation function up to this moment, actually, it seems to be a good way to go. And here is results that you get from a reference MD solution versus a join MD and continuum solution. And that's actually the differences. This is velocity coupling. This is velocity gradient coupling. This is the reference MD. We subtract the two fields, and you can see almost visually that the velocity gradient approach has fewer errors than the velocity coupling. Now, some bad news for this pair correlation function. What we found is that when you actually try to reduce the temperature or increase the density of the liquid, this method did not work. So what we found is we used this pair correlation function in the forcing term, but then the best density that we could get was like that. Still, it's within 10%, if you like, but we did not like that. So we came back to almost the penalization and the immersed boundary techniques by doing a very simple correction and a very simple idea. And this idea was, what if we use a simple PID controller where the quantity of interest that you have to conserve, if you like, is the density, and what if you come up with a force field that actually tries to reduce this distance between the desired density and the density that your coupling scheme gives you. What comes out of that is some very interesting potentials of mean force. Now, you can see the red here is by using the pair correlation function, and the black is the potential of mean force that comes out from this control algorithm. But besides their seemingly very small difference over here, there is a drastic difference on the kind of density profiles that you can get. So this control algorithm seems to be very useful. We have been using it also when you put a velocity going through. This is the density fluctuations you get. This is the velocity fluctuations. The velocity fluctuations you get, and you don't get things like that if you apply this control mechanism. Well, we have been using it for water, and you get some very interesting potentials of mean force there, but this thing seems to be working quite well. Here is an example of quet flow. I think Matej will say more later about coupling. We have been using it in coarse-grained MD of a membrane with continuum, and here is simulations where you basically cannot see that there has been a coupling here, but there is a coupling using this potential of mean. Closing, I want to tell you that what we are trying to pursue now is we try to take the different methods and also couple them into different computer architectures. We are using multi-core machines, multi-GPU architectures. This is one simulation where we have put a buckyball inside water, and then outside that we have lattice Boltzmann. And of course, what we would like to do is we'd like to do a simulation like that, which is all atomistic. But of course, we'd like to do it in a multi-scale fashion, so it's not as expensive as it is here. In closing, I'd like to close back with the Trojan War. And one thing that I realized from my adventure going from the continuum to the atomistic, in the continuum, you have conservation laws, you have approximations, you have theory, and you have convergence rates that you know when you're bad or when you're wrong. Going to the atomistic, there is a lot of modeling and a lot of empiricism that, at least for me, seems to introduce a lot of uncertainties. I mean, what are the experimental results we have? How the uncertainties in the experimental results are affecting the uncertainties in our potentials? And when we actually go into multiscaling, I see that we introduce a lot of algorithmic uncertainties, at least in the way that we do this work. And I think that's actually something that we need to worry about. I'd like to thank a few people. Michael Bergdorf is responsible for the wavelets and particles. Diego Rossinelli for the high-performance computing and visualization. Philippe Châtelain for a lot of the vorticity simulations. Basil Bayati has been doing a lot of work on adaptive mesh refinement for stochastic simulations that I did not show you today. And Babak Hezazyal Hosseini has been doing a lot of work on all these shock bubble interactions that I showed you briefly. Thank you very much for your time.
This matching or coupling between molecular dynamics and continuum mechanics. I'm curious about the connection to not a fluctuating hydrodynamics, but a deterministic hydrodynamics. And it would seem, given that MD trajectories rapidly become chaotic and stochastic-like, that a kind of fluctuating hydrodynamics matching might be more appropriate.
Yes, you're very correct.
Have you been thinking about that issue?
Yes, so the simulations that you showed on the buckyball, they actually contain a fluctuating part. Because some of the early simulations that I showed you the early simulations that I showed with a carbon nanotube in there, where is it? This one. Here we basically killed all the fluctuations and we were passing continuum atomistic. Now in the simulations a few slides later, and I think Matej will talk about that. Forget about this. In these ones, there is an intermediate mesoscale layer that I tries to do some of this stochasticity, takes care of some of the stochasticity that you are referring to. I think this is very important, and we need to have this layer.
Doesn't that depend upon whether the fluctuations actually matter and affect the
true
mean flow? I mean,
true.
In many cases, it doesn't, right?
So. True. True. That's the better statement, in fact. But I'd like to have methods that, in case they matter, they capture them. So the perspective for me is to have this thing and then to be able to take them in and out, if you like.
How do you control temperature and energy flows?
We have thermostats.
You have what type?
Berendsen thermostats. I don't remember all the details, but there is thermostatting that we have to introduce.
We've seen a few times in this conference that when you, let's say, fix a pair correlation function in liquid, the structure might come out right, but the pressure is wrong. And I was wondering, when you use a tuned potential between the wall and the fluid so that you get a flat structure, if you now want to use that wall in order to apply a pressure on your fluid, whether you get into trouble of not being able to apply the right pressure or not the pressure you think you're applying?
We have not checked the pressure fluctuations that we get. Pressure is also much more noisy and much more difficult quantity to get. But yes, that could be something that we have to come up with control mechanisms to take care of pressure as well, of controlling the pressure we want to apply.
Can I comment on that? Because
yeah.
Basically, these are you have fixed density, right?
Yes.
And the density sets the pressure. So as long as in that atomistic region you're controlling the density, then you're going to get the right pressure. There's also people like us that have put a little wall outside, and again, then the density fluctuations have decayed away. But there's no problem with the pressure being matched because you're not using anything artificial in the region that matters. That's just a boundary that's not so important for the overall flow.
Okay.
Back at the continuum level, I wonder if you could say a little bit more about the relationship between your approaches and immersed boundary methods. You touched on it. I wonder if you could say a little more.
I'm using immersed boundary methods. I'm not doing anything special. I'm just using immersed boundary methods. I'm using two different types. I'm using penalization techniques, and so there is this so-called penalization technique, and then there is this other technique called immersed boundaries. The difference between them is minimal. If you like. In one case, you have a delta function in your boundary. In other case, you have this penalization approach. The reason I like, if you want to talk a bit more hydrodynamics, the penalization approach, it allows you, I'm interested very much in swimming, and it allows me a very natural way to have self-propelled swimmers. In a sense, because I solve everywhere, and I don't focus only on the boundary because of this delta function, this thing, I don't need to compute forces in order to get self-propelled swimmers. I just move the body with whatever velocity the flow field gives me, and I can prove that this amounts to a solid body moving with the fluid. So I think between the two of them, I think they're almost equivalent, in my opinion. I find this to be a little bit more flexible for the type of hydrodynamics that I am doing. But I'd like also again to say that these methods are extremely convenient, extremely nice, but they're not as accurate as a body-fitted grid, and they will never be, in my opinion.
I like your discussion of the remeshing in SPH, and I'd like to ask what effect the frequency of remeshing has.
So we have studied that. So you start to do remeshing when the property of partition of unity fails. So if your particles are remaining overlapping, you don't need to do remeshing. And you can have, so if you take this zeta of epsilon function and you integrate it over sets of particles, whenever you don't get one, then it seems that you have a problem. Okay, then that's when you have to apply the remeshing. So that's an indicator of controlling the remeshing. In practice, doing remeshing at every step or every other step or every 5-10 steps, it depends very much on what kind of strains and such things you have in the flow field. We almost like to do it at every time step because the accuracy of the method is controlled by the type of remeshing that I do. As I increase the size of my remeshing stencil, I can almost get spectral accuracy if I remesh to every body, and I can show that. But remeshing allows me to do all this multi-resolution analysis and allows me to compute, since I want to use grid-based solvers to do all the Poisson solvers, etc. fast, I need to have things on the grid. So I might as well do it at each time step. So there is a whole study that I have done back in 1997 about frequency of remeshing, etc. The quick answer is, again, if the particles get very distorted, you have to do it. And that determines your time step, in fact.
Let me ask another question then. Sure. As I understood what you were saying with the atomistic continuum coupling, you were talking about fitting velocity gradient, but really you were just fitting the velocity at two levels.
Yeah.
Which is, again, what we always did because we found it was much more accurate than just fitting a single value at the edge. And it's really important when you start looking at thermal flows because, again, to get the heat flux correct, you need to match at multiple temperature points.
I did not know that. I mean, at some point we were playing with lattice Boltzmann and molecular dynamics, and then this guy, Alexandre Dupuy, he said, why don't we couple in more than one point? And actually, in fact, we don't couple when we do these things. This is a dirty business, in a sense. I'll tell you why. Because it's not clear on how many cells you have to couple. So when we did this cylinder and lattice Boltzmann and MD, he was coupling the lattice Boltzmann all the way down to the down to the nanotube, if you like. But I think in this case it didn't really matter. What really matters is what you do basically in the outer two layers that go into the continuum, because the continuum at some point doesn't care so much as to what happens. The fluid does not care so much as to what happens inside this region. But then for this other work that we did with Matei, I think I shouldn't take away your talk, we found that we need to have a gap between where the atomistic is passing to the continuum and where the continuum passing to the atomistic. But I don't know if you have a theory
critical for temperature flux.
Okay.
It turns out otherwise the coupling method acts as a heat source and you don't get conservation anymore. So you'll talk about, okay, sorry.
Yeah.
We have another 5 minutes or so if people would like to.
I think there's one thing that I missed, because when you said you really would like to remesh every time step, then I don't quite understand why you would ever go off lattice to begin with and just don't stay.
Well, because my advection is done Lagrangian. I never have to discretize the U dot grad term. I do it Lagrangian. Is it clear? So when you do inside here, Here, this is the Lagrangian derivative. Okay?
And after one step, you put it back on the test.
That's right. What that thing would be? What thing? Sure. I just show you that there is an equivalence to that. That there no there is a it's a matter of how you advect your particles. So you can write everything on a mess, but then you will have to worry about things like CFL conditions and such things. In the end, yes, behind every method, excuse me, Courant-Friedrichs-Levy is the thing that determines the stability of the numerical scheme, and it's usually for grid-based methods, U delta T over delta X. When we do Lagrangian methods, we don't have this U delta T over delta X, but our delta T is determined as inversely proportional to, let's say, the vorticity or some quantity like that. Basically, when you do Lagrangian methods, if I have an advection scheme, right, I never have to remesh because my particles just move straight, and then I never have to remesh. Now, there is an equivalent numerical scheme for that I can write it as a finite difference method, right? But then this is a different how you implement it. And one thing, I just advect particles. I know where my particles are going. I am adaptive in that sense. In the other case, I would need to have also an indicator as to where my particles are. So in the end, I can take anything Lagrangian and I can write it as a finite difference. But the adaptivity that my particles are giving me, let me give you a more precise example. Here, if you pay close attention, the particles that I plot here, they have been remeshed. Okay? But how this grid that I have, okay, this grid has been formulated because I follow particles. So if you have a grid-based method and you have an indicator that tells you which grid points are going to become active, then it's going to become a Lagrangian method as well. So what the particles do is they follow the dynamics of the flow field. They tell me where they are, and then I project onto the grid. So I agree with you that I can, in the end, write a finite difference scheme, but a priori, I would not know what is this finite difference scheme because I would not know where to put my grid points, etc. So here, we don't have grid points, if you like, everywhere. Okay, so there's a difference that if you do a grid-based method that has adaptive mesh, then you recover a particle method. That's another way to see it. Did I answer your question? Okay, we are office mates, so we can have something exciting to talk about.
Okay.
Nothing else? Well, Glenn, I guess you're
curious about your statement, Mark. What's the business that the fluctuations don't affect the average flows? Is that obvious?
I don't know if it's obvious that when fluctuations affect mean flows and when they don't.
Fluctuations affect the average flow.
Right, but typically for these flows you're at low Reynolds number.
Yeah.
And so unless you're looking at something like, say, breakup of a droplet or something where the fluctuations would be inherently important, then it's, if you're looking at, say, slip boundary conditions over a rough surface, for example, it's not obvious that there's any net effect from the fluctuating hydrodynamics. And if you do all MD and you compare to the hybrid methods, there's no difference in the time average flow in all the cases that we've looked at in these low Reynolds number flows. That doesn't mean that every case that'll be the case, and I'm not saying one shouldn't think about it, but one of the problems that we've run into is that when you include fluctuations and you couple to the continuum has long time scales. And those fluctuations couple out and persist over the continuum time scale. So if you have a very small atomistic and a big continuum, you may have to run your atomistic longer than's really feasible in order to see that that fluctuation average away. So putting them in can create some problems too.
If I may add, one place that I have seen fluctuations becoming important, we do some other simulations that I didn't have time to show you, where we do couple mesoscale systems with continuum systems. Front propagation, when you have front propagation, their fluctuations do make a difference, a huge difference as to what kind of propagation speeds you may have. So if we think about possibility of combustion and multiscaling and such things, I think when you have such sharp gradients on the quantity that you're tracking there, I think it would be imperative to do that. But at least for the hydrodynamics that we have been playing with, and just because, as Mark said, it's our very low Reynolds numbers, they don't seem to be affecting things very much. At least for the two flows that we have seen. I mean, that's that, yeah. Thank you.
Time for the last talk of this morning by Matej Propotnik on coupling atomistic and continuum hydrodynamics, and we've already apparently had many previews, so we look forward to the main event.